I wanted to know what he found so funny. "Might stop L," Alex read. "Let's assume that's Loki. Whetstone of Bulwark. You think that's the same thing as the Skulfnung stone?" I shuddered. We'd lost the Skulfnung stone and Skulfnung sword during a wedding party in Loki's cavern, when he'd escaped the bindings that had held him for 1,000 years. Oops, our bad. I never wanted to see that particular whetstone again. "I hope not," I said. "Ever heard the name Bulwark?" "Nope." Alex finished his guava juice. "I'm kind of digging this mead horn, though. You mind if I keep it?" "All yours." I found the idea of Alex taking a souvenir from my family mansion strangely pleasing. "So if Randolph wanted me to find that book, and Loki sent the wolves to get it before I could..." Alex tossed the journal back to me. "Assuming what you just said is true, and assuming it's not a trap, and assuming those notes aren't the ramblings of a madman?" Yeah. "Then best case scenario, your uncle came up with an idea to stop Loki. It wasn't something he could do himself, but he hoped you could. It involves a whetstone, a bulwark, and possibly a Scandinavian cow. When you put it like that, it doesn't sound so promising." Alex poked the tip of the mead horn. "Sorry to burst your bubble, but most plans to stop Loki fail. We know this." The bitter edge in his voice surprised me. "You're thinking about your training sessions with Sam," I guessed. "How are they going?" Alex's face told me the answer. Among Loki's many disturbing qualities, he could command his children to do whatever he wanted whenever they were in his presence, which made family reunions a real drag. Alex was the exception. He'd somehow learned to resist Loki's power, and for the past 6 weeks, he'd been trying to teach his half-sister Samira al-Abbas to do the same. The fact that neither of them talked much about their training suggested that it hadn't been a rousing success. "She's trying," Alex said. "It doesn't make it easier that she's..." He stopped himself. "What?" "Never mind. I promise not to talk about it." "Now I'm really curious. Is everything okay with her and Amir?" Alex snorted. "Oh yeah. They're still head over heels, dreaming of the day when they can get married. I swear, if those two didn't have me to chaperone them, they'd do something crazy like hold hands." "Then what's the problem?" Alex waved off my question. "All I'm saying is that you shouldn't trust anything you get from your Uncle Randolph. Not the advice in that book. Not this house. Anything you inherit from family. It always comes with strings attached." That seemed a strange thing for him to say, considering he'd been enjoying the view from Randolph's magnificent roof deck while sipping chilled guava juice from his Viking mead horn. But I got the feeling Alex wasn't really thinking about my dysfunctional uncle. "You never talk much about your family," I noted. "I mean your mortal family." He stared at me darkly. "And I'm not going to start now. If you knew half the Brock..." In a flutter of black feathers, a raven landed on the tip of Alex's boot. You don't see a lot of wild ravens in Boston. Canadian geese, seagulls, ducks, pigeons, even hawks, sure. But when a huge black raptor lands on your foot, that can only mean one thing. A message from Valhalla. Alex held out his hand. Not normally recommended with ravens. They have a vicious bite. The bird hopped on his wrist, barfed up a hard pellet the size of a pecan right into Alex's palm, and then flew away. Its mission accomplished. "Yes, our ravens deliver messages via barf mail." Ravens have a natural ability to regurgitate inedible substances like bones and fur, so they have no qualms about swallowing a message capsule, flying it across the nine worlds, and vomiting it to the correct recipient. It wouldn't have been my chosen career, but hey, no judgment. Alex cracked open the pellet. He unfolded the letter and began to read, the corner of his mouth starting to twitch again. "It's from TJ," he said. "Looks like we're leaving today. Right now, in fact." "What?" I sat up in my recliner. "Why?" Of course, I'd known we were running out of time. We had to leave soon in order to reach Loki's ship before midsummer. But there was a big difference between soon and right now. I wasn't a big fan of right now. Alex kept reading. "Something about the tide? I don't know. I'd better go bust Samira out of school. She'll be in calculus. She's not going to be happy about leaving." He rose and offered me a hand. I didn't want to get up. I wanted to stay there on that deck with Alex and watch the afternoon sunlight change the color of the river from blue to amber. Maybe we could read some of Randolph's old paperbacks. We could drink all his guava juice. But the Raven had barfed up our orders. You couldn't argue with Raven barf. I took Alex's hand and got to my feet. "You want me to come with you?" Alex frowned. "No, dummy. You've got to get back to Valhalla. You're the one with the boat. Speaking of which, have you warned the others about..." "No," I said, my face burning. "Not yet." Alex laughed. "That should be interesting. Don't wait for Sam and me. We'll catch up with you somewhere along the way." Before I could ask what he meant by that, Alex turned into a flamingo and launched himself into the sky, making it a banner day for Boston bird watchers. Chapter 5. I bid farewell to Eric, and also Eric. Legends tell us that Valhalla has 540 doors, conveniently distributed across the 9 worlds for easy access. The legends don't mention that one of those entrances is in the Forever 21 store on Newberry Street, just behind the women's activewear rack. It normally wasn't the entrance I liked to use, but it was the closest to Uncle Randolph's mansion. Nobody in Valhalla could explain to me why we had a gateway in Forever 21. Some speculated it was left over from a time when the building was not a retail store. Personally, I thought the location might be one of Odin's little jokes, since a lot of his Inherjar were literally Forever 21, or 16, or 60. My dwarf friend Blitzen especially hated that entrance. Every time I mentioned Forever 21, he would launch into a rant about how his fashions were much better. Something about hemlines. I don't know. I strolled through the lingerie section, getting a strange look from a sales lady, then dove into the activewear rack and popped out the other side in one of the Hotel Valhalla's game rooms. There was a pool tournament in progress, which Vikings play with spears instead of pool cues. Hint, never stand behind a Viking when he shoots. Eric the Green from floor 135 greeted me cheerfully. From what I can tell, approximately 72% of the population of Valhalla is named Eric. "Hail, Magnus Chase!" He pointed at my shoulder. "You've got some spandex just there." "Oh, thanks." I untangled the yoga pants that had gotten stuck on my shirt and tossed them into the bin marked for restocking. Then I strode off to find my friends. Walking through the Hotel Valhalla never got old. At least it hadn't for me so far. And Inherjar, who'd been here for hundreds of years, had told me the same thing. Thanks to the power of Odin, or the magic of the Norns, or maybe just the fact that we had an on-site IKEA, the decor was constantly changing, though it always incorporated a lot of spears and shields, and perhaps more wolf motifs than I would have liked. Even just finding the elevators required me to navigate hallways that had changed size and direction since the morning, past rooms I'd never seen before. In one enormous oak-paneled lounge, Warriors played shuffleboard with oars for pushers and combat shields for pucks. Many of the players sported leg splints, arm slings, and head bandages because, of course, Enheriar played shuffleboard to the death. The main lobby had been recarpeted in deep crimson, a great color to hide bloodstains. The walls were now hung with tapestries depicting Valkyries flying into battle against fire giants. It was beautiful work, though the proximity of so many wall torches made me nervous. Valhalla was pretty lax about safety codes. I didn't like burning to death. It was one of my least favorite ways to die, right up there with choking on the after-dinner mints in the feast hall. I took the elevator up to floor 19. Unfortunately, the elevator music hadn't changed. It was getting to the point that I could sing along with Frank Sinatra in Norwegian. I was just glad I lived on a low floor. If I lived somewhere up in the hundreds, I would have gone, well, berserk. On floor 19, everything was strangely quiet. No sounds of video game violence emanated from Thomas Jefferson Jr.'s room. Dead Civil War soldiers love their video games almost as much as they love charging up hills. I saw no signs that Mallory Keane had been practicing her knife throwing in the hallway. Half-born Gunderson's room was open and being serviced by a flock of ravens who swirled through his library and his weapons collection, dusting books and battle axes. The big man himself was nowhere to be seen. My own room had recently been cleaned. The bed was made. In the central atrium, the trees had been pruned and the grass mowed. I could never figure out how the ravens operated a lawnmower. On the coffee table, a note in TJ's elegant script read, "We're at Dock 23, sublevel 6. See you there." The TV had been turned to the Hotel Valhalla channel, which displayed a list of the afternoon's events. Racquetball, machine gun tag, like laser tag, except with machine guns, watercolor painting, Italian cooking, advanced sword sharpening, and something called flighting, all done to the death. I stared wistfully at the screen. I'd never wanted to practice watercolor painting to the death before, but now I was tempted. It sounded much easier than the trip I was about to take from Dock 23, sublevel 6. First things first, I showered off the smell of Boston Harbor. I changed into new clothes. I grabbed my go bag, camping supplies, some basic provisions, and of course, some chocolate bars. As nice as my hotel suite was, I didn't have much in the way of personal stuff. Just a few of my favorite books, and some photos from my past that magically appeared over time, gradually filling up the fireplace mantle. The hotel wasn't meant to be a forever home. We and Enheriar might stay here for centuries, but it was only a stopover on our way to Ragnarok. The whole hotel radiated a sense of impermanence and anticipation. "Don't get too comfortable," it seemed to say. "You might be leaving any minute to go die your final death at Doomsday. Hooray!" I checked my reflection in the full-length mirror. I wasn't sure why it mattered. I'd never cared much about appearances during the 2 years I'd lived on the streets, but lately Alex Fierro had been teasing me mercilessly, which made me more conscious of how I looked. Besides, if you don't check yourself from time to time in Valhalla, you could be walking around for hours with raven poop on your shoulder, or an arrow in your butt, or a pair of yoga pants wrapped around your neck. Hiking boots? Check. New pair of jeans? Check. Green Hotel Valhalla t-shirt? Check. Down jacket, appropriate for cold water expeditions and falling off masts? Check. Runestone pendant that could turn into a heartbroken magical sword? Check. After living on the streets, I wasn't used to my face looking so clean. I definitely wasn't used to my new haircut, which Blitz had first given me during our expedition into Jotunheim. Since then, every time it started to grow out, Alex hacked it off again, leaving my bangs just long enough to fall in my eyes, the back chopped to collar level. I was used to my hair being much wilder and more wiry, but Alex took such glee in murdering my blonde locks, it was impossible to tell him no. "It's perfect," Alex said. "Now you at least look like you're groomed, but your face is still obscured." I slipped Randolph's notebook into my pack, along with one last item I'd been trying hard not to think about, a certain silk handkerchief I'd gotten from my father. I sighed at the Magnus in the mirror. "Well, sir, you'd better get going. Your friends are eagerly waiting to laugh at you."
"There he is!"
yelled Halfborn Gunderson, berserker extraordinaire, speaker of the obvious. He barreled toward me like a friendly Mack truck. His hair was even wilder than mine used to be. I was pretty sure he cut it himself, using a battle axe, in the dark. He wore a t-shirt today, which was unusual, but his arms were still a wild landscape of muscle and tattoo. Strapped across his back was his battle axe, named Battle Axe, and holstered up and down his leather breeches were half a dozen knives. He wrapped me in a bear hug and lifted me off my feet, perhaps testing to make sure my ribcage would not crack under pressure. He put me down and patted my arms, apparently satisfied.
"You ready for a quest?" he bellowed. "I'm ready for a quest!"
From the edge of the canal, where she was coiling ropes, Mallory Keene called,
"Oh, shut up, you oaf! I still think we should use you as the rudder!"
Halfborn's face mottled red, but he kept his eyes on me.
"I'm trying not to kill her, Magnus. I really am. But it's so hard. I'd better keep busy, or I'm going to do something I'll regret. You have the handkerchief?"
Yes, but...
"Good man! Time's a-wasting!"
He tromped back to the dockside and began sorting his supplies. Huge canvas duffels, no doubt full of food, weapons, and lots of spare leather breeches. I scanned the length of the cavern. Along the left-hand wall, a river rushed through the canal, emerging from a train-sized tunnel on one end and disappearing into an identical tunnel on the other. The barreled ceiling was polished wood, amplifying the water's roar and making me feel like we were standing inside an old-fashioned root beer keg. Supplies and baggage lined the dock, just waiting for a ship to be put on. At the far end of the room, Thomas Jefferson Jr. stood deep in conversation with the hotel manager, Helgi, and his assistant, Hunding, all three of them looking over some paperwork on a clipboard. Since I had an aversion to paperwork, and also to Helgi, I walked over to Mallory, who was now stuffing iron grappling hooks into a burlap sack. She was dressed in black furs and black denim, her red hair pulled back in a severe bun. In the torchlight, her freckles glowed orange. As usual, she wore her trusty pair of knives at her sides. "Everything good?" I asked, because clearly it wasn't. She scowled.
"Don't you start too, mister."
She called me a Gaelic term I didn't recognize, but I was fairly sure it didn't mean dearest friend.
"We've been waiting on you in the boat."
"Where are Blitzen and Hearthstone?" It had been several weeks since I'd seen my dwarf and elf buddies, and I'd been looking forward to them sailing with us. One of the few things I was looking forward to. Mallory grunted impatiently.
"We're picking them up on the way."
That could have meant we were stopping by a different part of Boston, or stopping by a different world. But Mallory didn't look like she was in the mood to elaborate. She scanned the space behind me and scowled.
"What about Alex and Samira?"
"Alex said they'd meet us later."
"Well then."
Mallory made a shooing gesture.
"Go sign us out."
"Sign us out?"
"Yeah."
She drawled the word to indicate just how slow she thought I was.
"With Helgi, the manager. Off you go."
Since she was still holding a fistful of grappling hooks, I did what she told me. TJ had his foot planted on a supply box, his rifle across his back. The brass buttons gleamed on his Union Army coat. He tipped his infantry cap at me in greeting. Just in time, my friend. Helgi and Hunding exchanged nervous looks, the way they did whenever Odin announced one of his motivational staff retreats.
Magnus Chase, Helgi said, tugging at his roadkill beard.
He was dressed in his usual dark green pinstripe suit, which he probably thought made him look like a service industry professional, but only made him look like a Viking in a pinstripe suit.
We were beginning to worry. The high tide will be here any minute.
I looked at the water raging down the canal. I knew that several subterranean rivers wove their way through Valhalla, but I didn't understand how they could be subject to tides. I also didn't see how the water level here could get any higher without flooding the entire room. Then again, I was having a conversation with two dead Vikings and a Civil War soldier, so I decided to give logic a rest.
Sorry, I said.
I waved vaguely, trying to indicate reading mysterious journals, killing wolves, breaking my leg in Boston Harbor. TJ practically vibrated with excitement.
You got the boat? I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. I started rummaging in my knapsack, but the handkerchief seemed to have fallen to the bottom. Hunding wrung his hands. His bellhop uniform was buttoned wrong, like he'd rushed to get dressed this morning.
You didn't lose it, did you?
Oh, I warned you about leaving unattended magic items in your room. I told the cleaning ravens not to touch it. It's a warship, I said, not a napkin. But they kept wanting to launder it with the linens. If it's missing, then you'll be held responsible. Helgi snarled at the bellhop. Floor 19 is your service area.
Hunding winced. He and Helgi had a feud that went back several centuries.
The manager welcomed any excuse to make Hunding work extra shifts shoveling garbage into the incinerators or hosing out the lindworm warrens.
Relax. I pulled out the piece of cloth. See, here it is. And Hunding, this is for you.
I handed him one of my chocolate bars. Thanks for keeping an eye on my room while I'm gone.
The bellhop's eyes turned misty.
Kid, you're the best. You can leave unattended magic items in your room any time.
Humph.
Helgi scowled.
Well then, Magnus Chase, I'll need you to sign out.
He thrust the clipboard at me.
Read carefully and initial at the bottom of each page.
I flipped through a dozen pages of dense contract language. I skimmed over phrases like, in the event of death by squirrel attack, and the proprietor shall not be held liable for off-site dismemberment. No wonder my friends preferred to leave the hotel without permission. The release forms were brutal.
TJ cleared his throat.
So, Magnus, maybe while you're doing that, I could set up the boat? Can I? I'm ready to get this regiment underway.
I could tell. He was loaded down with enough ammunition pouches, haversacks, and canteens for a 30-day march. His eyes gleamed as brightly as his bayonet. Since TJ was usually the voice of reason on Floor 19, I was glad to have him along, even if he did get a little too excited about full frontal charges on enemy positions.
Yeah, I said. Sure, man.
Yay!
He plucked the handkerchief out of my hand and hustled toward the dock. I signed the release forms, trying not to get hung up on the clauses about arbitration in case we got incinerated in the fires of Muspelheim, or got pulverized by frost giants. I handed the clipboard back to Helgi. The manager frowned.
You sure you read everything?
Yeah. I'm a fast reader. Helgi gripped my shoulder.
Then good luck, Magnus Chase, son of Frey. And remember, you must stop Loki's ship, Naglfar, from sailing at midsummer.
I know.
Or Ragnarok begins.
Right.
Which means our renovations to the banquet hall won't ever be complete, and we'll never get high-speed internet restored on floor 242.
I nodded grimly. I did not need the extra pressure of being responsible for an entire floor's internet connection.
We'll succeed. Don't worry.
Helgi tugged at his beard.
But if you do start Ragnarok, could you please get back here as soon as possible, or send us a text?
Okay. A text? As far as I knew, the hotel staff just used Ravens. They didn't know how to use mobile devices. None of them even had numbers. But that didn't stop them from talking a good game.
We'll need to get everyone started on their checkout surveys before we march off to Doomsday, Helgi explained, to expedite their deaths. If you can't make it back, you can also fill out your survey online. And if you wouldn't mind marking excellent wherever it mentions the manager, I'd appreciate it. Odin does read those.
But if we're all going to die anyway...
Good man! He patted my shoulder. Well, have a safe, successful journey.
He tucked the clipboard under his arm and strolled off, probably going to inspect those renovations to the banquet hall. Hunding sighed.
That man has no sense. Thanks for the chocolate, though, my boy. I just wish there was something more I could do for you.
My scalp tingled with inspiration. During my time at the hotel, Hunding had become my best source of information. He knew where all the bodies were buried. Literally. He knew all the secret room service menu items, and how you could get from the lobby to the observation deck above the Grove of Glacier without having to pass through the gauntlet of gift shops. He was a walking Vikingpedia. I pulled out Randolph's journal and showed him the last page. Any idea what this word means? I pointed to Meoth. Hunding laughed.
It says mead, of course.
Huh. So it has nothing to do with cows.
Pardon?
Never mind. What about this name here? Bulwark. Hunding flinched so violently, he dropped his chocolate bar.
Bulwark? No!
No, no, no. What is this book, anyway? Why would you possibly...
Arg!
Halfborn yelled from dockside.
Magnus, we need you over here now!
The river was starting to surge, frothing and lapping over the edge of the canal. TJ shook the handkerchief desperately, yelling,
How does it work? How does it work?
It hadn't occurred to me that the foldable ship, being a gift from my dad, might only work for me. I ran over to help. Mallory and Halfborn were scrambling to gather their supplies.
We've got a minute at most before the high tide comes flooding through here, yelled Halfborn. Ship, Magnus! Now!
I took the handkerchief and tried to steady my shaking hands. I'd practiced this ship-unfolding trick a couple of times on calmer water, once by myself and once with Alex, but I could still hardly believe it would work. I definitely wasn't looking forward to the results. I flicked the handkerchief toward the water. As soon as the cloth hit the surface, the corners unfolded and unfolded and kept unfolding. It was like watching the building of a Lego model in a sped-up stop-motion video. In the space of two breaths, a Viking longship lay at anchor in the canal, the turbulent water coursing around its stern. But of course, nobody complimented me on its beautifully trimmed hull, or the elaborate Viking shields lining the rails, or the five rows of oars ready for service. No one noted how the mainmast was hinged and folded over so it could pass through this low tunnel without breaking apart. No one gasped at the beauty of the carved dragon figurehead, or praised the fact that the ship was much larger and more spacious than your typical longship, even boasting a covered area below decks so we wouldn't have to sleep in the rain and snow. Mallory Keene's first comment was,
Can we talk about the color?
TJ frowned.
Why is it...
I don't know, I wailed.
I don't know why it's yellow.
My father, Frey, had sent me the boat weeks ago, promising that it was the perfect vessel to use on our voyage. It would get us where we needed to go. It would protect us on the most treacherous seas. My friends had been excited. They had trusted me, even when I'd refused to give them a preview of our magical ship. But why, oh why, had my father made the boat the color of I can't believe it's not butter? Everything about it was neon, eye-melting yellow. The ropes, the shields, the hull, the sail, the rudder, even the dragon figurehead. For all I knew, the bottom of the keel was yellow too, and we'd blind every fish we sailed past.
Well, it doesn't matter now,
Halfborn said, scowling at me like it mattered very much.
Load up! Hurry!
A roar echoed from the upstream tunnel like an approaching freight train. The ship banged against the dock. Halfborn tossed our supplies on deck as TJ held up the anchor, while Mallory and I held the mooring lines fast with all our inherent strength. Just as Halfborn threw the last sacks, a wall of water burst out of the tunnel behind us.
Let's go! Yelled TJ.
We jumped aboard as the wave slammed into our stern, propelling us forward like the kick of a 70-million-gallon mule. I glanced back at the dock one last time. Hounding the bellhop stood knee-deep in water, clutching his chocolate bar, staring at me as we rocketed into the darkness, his face bleached with shock as if, after all these centuries of dealing with the dead in Valhalla, he'd finally seen an actual ghost. Chapter 6. I have a nightmare about toenails. I like my rivers the way I like my enemies. Slow, wide, and lazy. I rarely get what I like. Our boat shot down the rapids in near total darkness. My friends scrambled around the deck, grabbing ropes and tripping over oars. The ship rocked side to side, making me feel like I was surfing on a pendulum. Mallory hugged the rudder with her full weight, trying to keep us in the middle of the current.
"Don't just stand there!" she yelled at me. "Help!"
The old saying is true. No nautical training survives first contact with the water. I'm pretty sure that's an old saying. Everything I'd learned from Percy Jackson evaporated out of my brain. I forgot starboard and port, stern and aft. I forgot how to discourage shark attacks and how to fall off a mast properly. I hopped across the deck yelling, "I'm helping! I'm helping!" without knowing what to do at all. We swerved and sloshed through the tunnel at impossible speeds, our retracted mast barely clearing the roof. The tips of our oars scraped against the stone walls, leaving trails of bright yellow sparks that made it look like fairies were ice skating alongside us. TJ rushed past me, heading for the prow, and nearly impaled me with his bayonet.
"Magnus, hold that line!"
he yelled, waving at pretty much every rope on the ship. I grabbed the nearest bit of rigging and pulled as hard as I could, hoping I had the right line, or hoping I at least looked helpful while doing the wrong thing. We bumped down a series of cataracts. My teeth clattered out telegraph messages. Frigid waves crashed over the shields on the railing. Then the tunnel widened and we sideswiped a rock that came out of nowhere. The boat spun a 360. We dropped down a waterfall toward certain death, and as the air turned to cold, misty soup around us, everything went dark. What a fantastic time to have a vision! I found myself standing on the deck of a different ship. In the distance, glacial cliffs rimmed a vast bay marbled with ice. The air was so cold, a layer of frost crackled over my coat sleeves. Beneath my feet, instead of wooden planking, spread a bumpy surface of glistening gray and black, like the shell of an armadillo. The entire ship, a Viking vessel the size of an aircraft carrier, was made of the same stuff, and unfortunately I knew what it was. The clipped toenails and fingernails of the dishonored dead. Billions upon billions of nasty zombie cuttings, all cobbled together by evil pedicurist magic to create Naglfar, the Ship of Nails, also known as the Ship of the Dead. Above me, gray sails rippled in the freezing wind. Shuffling across the deck were thousands of desiccated human husks dressed in rusted armor. Draugr, Viking zombies. Giants strode among them, shouting orders and kicking them to form ranks. Out of the corners of my eyes, I caught glimpses of darker things, too. Incorporeal shades that might have been wolves or serpents or skeletal horses made of smoke.
"Look who's here!"
said a cheerful voice. Standing before me, in the white uniform of a Navy admiral, was Loki himself. His autumn leaf-colored hair swept around the edges of his flag officer's hat. His intense irises glinted like rings of hardening amber, suffocating the life out of his poor trapped pupils. Despite the pitted wreckage of his face, damaged from centuries of snake venom dripping between his eyes, despite the scarred and twisted lips that had once been sewn together by an angry dwarf, Loki grinned in such a warm, friendly way, it was almost impossible not to smile back.
"Coming to visit me?" he asked.
"Awesome!"
I tried to yell at him. I wanted to berate him for getting my uncle killed, for torturing my friends, for ruining my life and causing me 6 solid months of indigestion. But my throat was filled with wet cement.
"Nothing to say?"
Loki chuckled.
"That's all right, because I've got plenty to tell you. First, a friendly warning. I'd really think twice about following old Randolph's plan."
His expression tightened with false sympathy.
"I'm afraid the poor man got a little senile there toward the end. You'd have to be crazy to listen to him."
I wanted to strangle Loki, but my hands felt strangely heavy. I looked down and saw that my fingernails were growing at unnatural speed, stretching toward the deck like taproots seeking soil. My feet felt too tight in my shoes. Somehow I knew that my toenails were also lengthening, pushing through my socks, trying to escape the confines of my hiking boots.
"What else?"
Loki tapped his chin.
"Oh yes! Look!"
He gestured past the hordes of shuffling zombies, sweeping his arm across the bay as if revealing a fabulous prize I'd just won. On the misty horizon, one of the glacial cliffs had begun to calve, sheeting massive curtains of ice into the water. The sound hit me half a second later, a muffled rumble like thunder through thick clouds.
"Cool, huh?"
Loki grinned.
"The ice is melting much faster than I thought. I love global warming. We'll be able to sail before the week is out. So really, you're already too late. I'd turn around and go back to Valhalla if I were you. You've only got a few days to enjoy yourself before Ragnarok hits. Might as well take some of those fabulous yoga classes."
My rebellious fingernails reached the deck. They wove their way into the glistening gray surface, pulling me down, forcing me to double over. My toenails burst through the tips of my boots. They rooted me in place, while dead men's nails began to grow upward like saplings, curling eagerly around my shoelaces, vining their way up my ankles. Loki looked down at me with a gentle smile, as if watching a toddler take his first steps.
"Yes, it's a wonderful week for doomsday. But if you do insist on challenging me..."
He sighed and shook his head like, "You crazy kids and your quests."
"Then please leave my children out of it, will you? Poor Sam and Alex. They've suffered enough. If you care for them at all, well, this quest will destroy them. I promise you that. They have no idea what they'll be facing."
I fell to my knees. I could no longer tell where my own fingernails and toenails stopped, and the ship began. Jagged branches of gray and black keratin tightened around my calves and wrists, chaining me to the deck, encircling my limbs, pulling me down into the fabric of the ship itself.
"Take care, Magnus!" Loki called. One way or another, we'll talk again soon.
A rough hand clamped my shoulder, shaking me awake.
Magnus! Yelled Halfborn Gunderson. Snap out of it, man! Grab an oar!
I found myself back on the deck of our bright yellow ship. We were drifting sideways through a cold, dense fog, the current pulling us to port, where the river fell away into roaring darkness. I swallowed the wet cement clogging my throat. Is that another waterfall? Mallory dropped on the bench next to me.
One that'll send us straight into Geenengagap and kill us, yeah. You feel like rowing now?
TJ and Halfborn took the bench in front of us. Together, we four rowed with all our strength, turning starboard and dragging our ship away from the precipice. My shoulders burned. My back muscles screamed in protest. Finally, the roaring sound faded behind us. The fog burned away, and I saw that we were in Boston Harbor, not far from Old Ironsides. Rising on my left were the brick row houses and church steeples of Charlestown. TJ turned and grinned.
See? That wasn't so bad.
Sure, Mallory said, except for almost falling off the edge of the world and being vaporized.
Halfborn stretched his arms.
I feel like I've just carried an elephant up Bunker Hill. But good job, all.
He faltered when he saw my face.
Magnus, what is it?
I stared at my trembling hands. I felt as if my fingernails were still growing, trying to find their way back to the ship of the dead. I had a little vision, I muttered. Give me a sec. My friends exchanged wary looks. They all knew there was no such thing as a little vision. Mallory Keene scooted closer to me.
Gunderson, why don't you take the rudder?
Halfborn frowned.
I don't take orders from...
Mallory glared at him. Halfborn muttered under his breath and went to take the rudder. Mallory fixed me with her eyes, the green irises flecked with brown and orange like the shells of cardinal's eggs.
Was it Loki you saw?
Normally, I didn't get this close to Mallory unless she was pulling an axe out of my chest on the battlefield. She valued her personal space. There was something troubling about her gaze, a sort of free-floating anger, like a fire that jumped from rooftop to rooftop. You never knew what it would burn and what it would leave alone.
Yeah,
I explained what I'd seen. Mallory's lip curled with disgust.
That trickster. We've all been seeing him in our nightmares lately. When I get my hands on him...
Hey, Mallory, TJ chided. I know you want revenge even more than most of us, but... Keen stopped him with a harsh look. I wondered what TJ was talking about. I'd heard that Mallory had died trying to disarm a car bomb in Ireland, but beyond that, I knew very little of her past. Had Loki been responsible for her death? She gripped my wrist, her calloused fingers reminding me uncomfortably of the keratin vines of Naglfar.
Magnus, Loki's calling you out. If you have that dream again, don't talk to him. Don't be baited.
Baited into what? I asked. Behind us, Halfborn yelled,
Valkyrie at 10 o'clock!
He pointed to the Charlestown waterfront. About a quarter mile ahead, I could just make out two figures standing on the dock, one with a green hijab, the other with green hair. Mallory scowled at Gunderson.
Do you have to be so loud, you oaf?
This is my regular voice, woman!
Yes, I know. Loud and annoying.
If you don't like it...
Magnus, she said, we'll talk later.
She stomped over to the deck hatch, where Halfborn had dropped his battle axe during all the confusion. She scooped up the weapon and brandished it at Halfborn.
You can have this back when you start to behave.
She slid down the ladder and disappeared below decks.
Oh, no, she didn't.
Halfborn abandoned his post and marched after her. The ship began to list to starboard. TJ scrambled back and took the rudder. He sighed. Those two picked a terrible time to break up.
Wait, what?
I asked. TJ raised his eyebrows. You didn't hear? Halfborn and Mallory argued so much, it was hard to tell when they were angry and when they were just showing affection. Now that I thought about it, though, they had been a little more aggressive with each other the last few days.
Why the breakup?
TJ shrugged.
The afterlife is a marathon, not a sprint.
Long-term relationships are tricky when you live forever. It's not uncommon for inherited couples to break up 60, 70 times over the course of a few centuries. I tried to imagine that. Of course, I'd never been in a relationship, long-term or otherwise, so I couldn't.
And we're stuck on a ship with them, I noted.
While they're working out their differences, surrounded by a wide assortment of weapons.
They're both professionals, said TJ. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Thunk! Below my feet, the deck shuddered with the sound of an axe impaling wood.
Right, I said.
And the stuff Mallory was saying about Loki?
TJ's smile melted.
We all have our problems with that trickster. I wondered what TJ's were. I'd lived with my friends on Floor 19 for months now, but I was starting to realize how little I knew about their pasts.
Thomas Jefferson Jr., former infantryman in the 54th Massachusetts, son of the war god Tyr and a freed slave. TJ never seemed to get flustered, even when he got killed on the battlefield, or when he had to intercept Halfborn Gunderson sleepwalking naked through the halls and get him back to his room. TJ had the sunniest disposition of any dead person I knew, but he must have seen his share of horrors. I wondered what sort of ammunition Loki used to taunt him in his dreams.
Mallory said Loki was calling me out, I remembered, and that I shouldn't take the bait.
TJ flexed his fingers, as if he were having sympathetic pains from his father Tyr, who'd gotten his hand bitten off by Fenris Wolf.
Mallory's right. Some challenges you should never take, especially from Loki.
I frowned. Loki had used the term challenge, too. Not fight. Not stop. He'd said, if you do insist on challenging me.
TJ, isn't your dad the god of personal challenges and duels and whatnot?
Exactly. TJ's voice was as stiff and flat as the hardtack bread he loved to eat. He pointed to the docks.
Look, Sam and Alex have company.
I hadn't noticed earlier, but lurking a few feet behind the children of Loki, leaning against the hood of his car in his jeans and teal work shirt, was my favorite supplier of fresh falafel sandwiches. Amir Fadlan, Samira's fiancé, had come to see us off.
Chapter 7 We All Drown.
Wow! Said Samira as we approached the dock. You're right, Alex. That ship is really yellow.
I sighed. Not you too. Alex grinned.
I vote we name it the Big Banana. All in favor?
Don't you dare, I said.
I love it,
Mallory said, throwing Alex a mooring line. Keenan Gunderson had emerged from below decks in an apparent truce, though both sported fresh black eyes.
It's decided then, bellowed Halfborn. The good ship, Mikkel Guller!
TJ scratched his head. There's an old Norse term for big banana?
Well, not exactly, Halfborn admitted. The Vikings never sailed far enough south to discover bananas. But Mikkel Guller means big yellow. That's close enough.
I looked skyward with a silent prayer. Frey, god of summer, dad, thanks for the boat. But could I suggest that forest green is also a great summery color? And please stop embarrassing me in front of my friends. Amen.
I climbed ashore
and helped tie up the big yellow humiliation, my legs still wobbly from the rough river ride and my vision of Loki. If I felt this grateful to be back on dry land after only a few minutes of travel, our journey across the sea promised to be tons of fun. Amir shook my hand.
How are you, Magnus?
Even after all these months, he sometimes slipped and called me Jimmy. That was my bad. During the 2 years I'd been homeless, Amir and his dad had been one of my few dependable sources of hot meals. They'd given me leftovers from their restaurant in the transportation building food court. In exchange for their kindness, I hadn't trusted them with my real name. I still felt guilty about that.
Yeah, I'm good.
I realized I was deceiving him yet again. I mean, as good as can be expected, given that we're heading off on another dangerous quest. Samira nudged my ribs with the butt of her axe.
Hey, don't get him agitated. I've spent the past few days trying to convince Amir not to worry.
Alex smirked. And I've spent the past few days chaperoning them as she tried to convince him not to worry. It's been very cute. Samira blushed. She was dressed in her typical travel clothes. Leather boots, sturdy cargo pants fitted with two axes, a long-sleeved turtleneck, and a dark green jacket that complemented her magical hijab. The fabric of the headscarf rippled in the breeze, catching the colors from her surroundings and ready to go into full camouflage mode at a moment's notice. Sam's face, though, seemed a little off. Her lips were dry and peeling, her eyes sunken and dull like she was suffering from a vitamin deficiency.
You okay? I asked her.
Of course. I'm fine.
But I could smell the ketones on her breath, a stale sour scent like lemons left out in the sun. It was the smell of someone who hadn't eaten in a while. I'd gotten used to that on the streets.
Nah, I decided. You're not okay.
She started to deny it, but Amir interceded.
Ramadan started 2 weeks ago, he said. We're both fasting.
Amir?
Sam protested.
Well, Magnus is a friend. He deserves to know.
Alex was working his jaw, trying to bite back his frustration.
Of course Alex had known.
That's what he'd been talking about at Uncle Randolph's. The reason Sam was having so much trouble focusing on her training. I didn't know much about Ramadan, but I knew a lot about going hungry. It can seriously mess up your concentration.
So, what are the rules about that? I asked.
It will not affect me on this quest, Sam promised. I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want anyone worrying. It's just no drinking or eating during daylight hours.
Or bathing, Amir said. Or cursing. Or smoking. Or violence.
Which is fine, Alex said, because our quests never involve violence. Sam rolled her eyes.
I can still defend myself if attacked. It's only 1 month.
1 month? I asked.
I've done this every year since I was 10, Sam said. Believe me, it's no big deal.
It sounded like a pretty big deal to me, especially in the summer when the days were so long, and we'd be facing all sorts of life and death situations that would not wait until after regular business hours.
Couldn't you, like, take a rain check until after our quest?
She could, Amir said. That's allowable if you're traveling, or if fasting would be too dangerous, both of which are true in this case.
But she won't. Alex chimed in. Because she is as stubborn as a very devout mule.
Sam poked Alex in the ribs.
Watch it, brother.
Ow, Alex complained. What happened to no violence?
I was defending myself, Sam said.
Hey, you all! Halfborn called from the ship. We're loaded up and ready to sail! What are you gabbing about? Come on!
I looked at Amir, as well-groomed as always, his clothes spotless and perfectly ironed, his dark hair cut to razor-straight perfection. You'd never guess he was a guy who was probably weak from hunger and thirst. But his facial muscles were more taut than usual. His gentle brown eyes kept blinking like he was expecting a drop of cold water to splash on his forehead. Amir was suffering, but it was from something that had nothing to do with Ramadan.
"Just be careful," he pleaded. "All of you. Magnus, I'd ask you to watch out for Samira, but if I did that, she would hit me with her axe."
"I would never hit you with my axe," Sam said. "Anyway, I'll be watching out for Magnus, not the other way around."
"I'll watch out for Sam," Alex volunteered. "That's what family is for, right?" Amir blinked even more. I got the sense that he still wasn't sure what to make of Alex Fierro, Sam's green-haired, gender-fluid, half-sibling chaperone of doom.
"Okay," Amir nodded.
"Thanks." I couldn't help feeling guilty about Amir's anguish. Months ago, when he'd started seeing into Samira's weird double life as a Valkyrie of Odin, I'd healed his mind to keep him from going insane. Now his mortal eyes were permanently opened. Rather than living in blissful ignorance, he could see the earth giants that occasionally strolled down Commonwealth Avenue, the sea serpents that frolicked in the Charles River, and the Valkyries that flew overhead, bringing souls of fallen heroes to check in at the Hotel Valhalla. He could even see our huge Viking warship that looked like a heavily armed banana. "We'll be careful," I told him. "Besides, nobody would dare attack this ship. It's way too yellow." He mustered a faint smile.
"That much is true."
He reached behind him. From the hood of his car, he hefted a large green insulated pack, the kind Fadlan's falafel used for deliveries. "This is for you, Magnus. I hope you enjoy." The scent of fresh falafel wafted out. True, I'd eaten falafel just a few hours ago, but my stomach growled because, well, more falafel. "Man, you're the best. I can't believe... Wait, you're in the middle of a fast and you brought me food? That seems wrong. Just because I'm fasting doesn't mean you can't enjoy." He clapped me on my shoulder. "You'll be in my prayers. All of you." I knew he was sincere. Me, I was an atheist. I only prayed sarcastically to my own father for a better color of boat. Learning about the existence of Norse deities and the nine worlds had just made me more convinced that there was no grand divine plan. What kind of god would allow Zeus and Odin to run around in the same cosmos, both claiming to be the king of creation, smiting mortals with lightning bolts and giving motivational seminars? But Amir was a man of faith. He and Samira believed in something bigger, a cosmic force that actually cared about humans. I suppose it was kind of comforting to know Amir had my back in the prayer department, even if I doubted there was anybody at the other end of that line. "Thanks, man." I shook his hand one last time. Amir turned to Sam. They stood a few feet apart, not touching. In all the years they'd known each other, they had never touched. I wondered if that was killing Amir even worse than the fasting. I wasn't much of a toucher myself, but every once in a while, a hug from somebody I cared about could go a long way. Caring about each other as much as Sam and Amir did, and not even being able to hold hands? I couldn't imagine that.
"I love you," Amir told her.
Samira stumbled backward like she'd been hit in the face with a giant eagle egg. Alex propped her up.
Yes, Sam squeaked. "Also, too."
Amir nodded. He turned and got into his car. A moment later, his taillights disappeared down Flagship Way. Samira smacked her own forehead.
"Also? Two? I am such an idiot."
Alex patted her arm. "I thought you were quite eloquent. Come on, sister.
Your neon-yellow warship awaits. We undid the mooring lines, extended the mast, hoisted the sail, and did a bunch of other nautical stuff.